Welcome back to another episode of the Do It Right podcast, where we spotlight the voices shaping the future of osteopathic medicine. I'm your co-host, Seth Johnson, joined by my fellow co-host, Brevin, and also tech support from Karina. All of us are proud student doctors. Today, we are truly honored to be joined by our inspiring guest, Dr. Roberts. She's a board-certified osteopathic OBGYN practicing in Southern Mississippi. She serves a vital role in her community by providing care to both insured and uninsured patients in a rural clinic setting. In addition to her clinical work, she's also shaping the future of medicine as a faculty member in the Department of Family Medicine at William Carey University, College of Osteopathic Medicine. In this conversation, we'll explore how the field of OB-GYN has evolved, what it's like to serve in the rural health setting, and what advice she has for medical students interested in pursuing OB-GYN. All from the lens of someone who is deeply committed to both medicine and mentorship. Dr. Roberts, thank you so much for joining us. We're excited to dive in.
Of course, it's my pleasure.
Great. Yeah, we're happy to have you. Just to start off, could you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you became interested in OBGYN?
Yeah, of course. So I've always been interested in women's health, even in medical school. It just seemed like a natural fit for me. I was a peer educator in undergrad, and I gravitated towards the women's health clinic on the campus of University of Southern Mississippi where I was. And again, it just seemed like a natural fit to me. So that's why I chose it. That's what kind of brought me to it. You know, I'm a Mississippi born and raised physician. Didn't go to school here, went to Nova Southeastern University College of Osteopathic Medicine in Florida, Fort Lauderdale, Florida, after graduating with my master's degree in public health from University of Southern Mississippi. I always knew I wanted to come back, but I thought it would be valuable to get out and kind of see how things were other places. That, and I really wasn't the greatest candidate for medical school, so I was going where they let me in, and Nova gave me a chance, so mm-hmm. I went there. Once I finished there, I kind of continued to grow in my love and interest of women's health, and it became more of a passion for me, and so it was really natural once I finished medical school to apply for OBGYN residency. Again, I sort of made the choice to go a little bit outside of the area just to kind of have that experience. I ended up doing my residency at Good Sam Hospital in West Islip, New York. And so that was a real challenge, very busy, challenging residency. But again, my love of women's health and my passion for that area of medicine never did waver. And made a commitment to come back here to one of my mentors as an undergrad, and fulfilled that commitment by coming back here to practice. So yeah, here I am. Not a super, it's interesting to me, right? But it's not anything profound. There was nothing in my life that happened that led me to women's health. It just was a natural interest and passion that was planted in me. And I think that's important too, to follow that. Mm-hmm. So for me, that's what it was.
Awesome. Yeah, sounds like you found a great fit. Do you remember your first delivery?
I do remember my first delivery. I was a third year medical student at Florida Hospital in Orlando. Maybe I shouldn't call the hospital out. This is many years ago, so I'm sure I would not get in any trouble or get anybody in any trouble. It was a C-section, and my mentor at the time was Dr. Ashley Hill, and he's still part of that program there. In fact, they have a residency now, and I got the opportunity to scrub in for the C-section. And so I put my sterile gown on and my gloves. First time being there, nervous as heck, and I'm standing across the table because he gave me the first assist position. So I'm standing across the table from him, and my last name was West at the time, and he says, "West?" And I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "Have you ever done a C-section before?" And I said, "No, sir, I have not." He said, "You're going to remember this day for the rest of your life." And he drew a line where the incision was supposed to go over the drape, gave me the scalpel, and I made the incision, and it was field.
Yeah, that sounds really cool.
So that was my first real delivery that I was, mm-hmm. you know, sort of involved in and was meaningful and impactful to me for sure. Mm-hmm.
So you mentioned that was your first delivery. So mm-hmm. I kind of want to talk about like how the field of OBGYN has evolved since you started. So a little bit about not only how it has evolved, but like what do you see changing in the future?
Yeah, I see it changing in a lot of ways. You know, if you think about obstetrics, first of all, I always say this has been happening for thousands of years, right? So mm-hmm. what's humbling about obstetrics or the obstetrical part is that oftentimes whether I'm standing there or not, it's gonna happen, right? But what I've seen it has been a big change from, you know, being more sterile with this procedure. And I don't mean that in a technically sterile. I mean, we were always sterile with what we do, right? And mm-hmm. in terms of medical procedures and things like that. But treating it like it's a procedure versus making it part of a natural part of life, right? So mm-hmm. What I've seen is a lot more openness to various laboring methods, things like that. So that's been really refreshing. I think it's refreshing to patients. A lot more patience with the delivery process and you know, in a safe manner, giving it the time that it deserves versus the old, you know, if you haven't delivered by 5 o'clock, you're getting a C-section kind of stuff, you know, and believe it or not, you know, we've been through periods of time where that was part of it. I've seen that change from a gynecologic perspective, seeing a lot of, you know, the guidelines with pap smears and things like that change, but also the surgical methods that we use. You know, lots of surgeries were done as open procedures mm-hmm. in the past, and there have been a lot of advances in the field of gynecologic surgery with regard to laparoscopic procedures, robotic procedures. Those are some of the best, most interesting procedures to watch is the robotic hysterectomies. Very, very interesting stuff happening. So a lot of changes, and I'm sure that there are more to come. Mm-hmm. I really feel like we probably will see more of a swing towards, again, more of, you know, with from the obstetrical perspective, more sensitivity in terms of pain management for deliveries mm-hmm. and the natural birth process, more of a push towards the, you know, we're already doing skin to skin and breastfeeding within the mm-hmm. first hour of delivery, as long as things go well. So I think we will see more of that, and I think that's a good thing. It makes it feel more like a natural human process.
So with you seeing the more push to, like, I guess moving more from like a more medical stance on it, but treating it also like a natural process that's mm-hmm. been occurring for years, how do you feel about home births and people wanting to, you know, deliver babies at home the more natural way, like in a birthing bath or something like that? So how do you feel? What are your thoughts?
Oh, that's a tough question. I feel some of my colleagues eyeing me like, what? So, you know, first and foremost, patients are patients, right? And they have a right to choose the way that they deliver their babies and in the setting that they deliver their babies. I'm an advocate for anything that is safe. I'm an advocate for patients being fully aware of risk, benefits, and alternatives to those procedures. The truth of a home birth, and I'm not opposed to those, but the truth of the matter is that sometimes those can turn out really badly, really fast. So I think, you know, if as long as a patient feels that they're in a safe environment, they're making the choice, they're educated, they've got all the facts. And what I like to see with a home birth, if that's the choice that a patient makes or any other, you know, sort of alternative form of delivery, is that they also have a plan B, and it's a valid and realistic mm-hmm. Plan B. In case there's a problem, what are we gonna do if? And I think that is one of the only ways that you can make those scenarios as safe as possible.
Yes.
Again, I'm not against or for it. What I am for is patients making choices for things that they feel are comfortable, as long as it's safe for mom and baby, and as long as they have all the facts.
Yes, ma'am.
So I think that's important.
Yeah, and in regards to patient safety or current technology advancements in medicine, what are some things that today's OB residents are learning that maybe didn't exist when you were in training?
I think they're learning a lot more robotic surgery. And in terms of safety, those procedures are getting patients out of the hospital faster and well and up and active faster. Mm. So I think that probably to me is one of the biggest things.
Gotcha. So what keeps you passionate about OB after all of these years?
What keeps me passionate about OB after all these years is the patients, really. Mm. You know what? It's the patients, but also I'm in a unique position where I'm also here at the medical school and I'm teaching students too. Mm. And so my patients keep me motivated, but seeing you guys come up through the years and develop interest in different fields and you know, specifically for OBGYN, that thrills me to no end to feel like I've played a part in that, to feel like I've played a part in a successful delivery, finding a breast cancer that maybe a patient didn't find before or didn't know was there, or a cervical cancer, or just sitting down with a patient and talking to them in the office about, you know, something that's going on with them, and taking the time to pull up charts and educate them and go through, well, this is happening because of this. I can't tell you how many times I've had patients that'll leave the office and they'll say, thank you for telling me about that, because I didn't know, and I feel like now I understand why I'm hurting or why this is happening. And that gives me more fuel and passion for the field than anything else. It's just, you know, I would say the patients and then seeing you guys be excited about it too.
That's great.
Yeah, well, we appreciate having educators like you that are passionate about helping us. What's one myth or misconception about OBGYN that you think still lingers?
Oh, that's a good one. I like that question. So I think one of the myths, are you talking about in terms of like for medical students in general?
It could be.
Like for residencies?
General. Yeah, either way.
I don't know why my mind went straight to this. I think the field of OBGYN is changing a lot. And so you have a lot of options where in the past, when you graduated, you would join a private practice or maybe a hospital-owned practice or something like that, and you maybe had two or three other partners in your group. You're taking call every second, third, or fourth night, and it's, you know, the 24-hour call, and it's just this very stressful, and it still is stressful. I'm not saying that, but just this very exhausting, I guess, thing. There are a lot of options with OBGYN. There are OB hospitalist positions that you can take. So those positions are more like ER shifts in some ways. And so these people that take these positions will work for a few 12-hour shifts or 24-hour shifts per week, but you work in the hospital and you're laboring patients. So it relieves those docs who are in private practice, who maybe are in a smaller practice that, you know, are really exhausted with taking call that often. And so that's an option. A lot of people don't know that there are also fellowships associated with OBGYN that also have a different level of, you know, hour requirements and things like that. So there's, you know, maternal fetal medicine and reproductive endocrinology. So those are a couple of examples of fields that maybe don't have to take call as much. You're not as involved in deliveries and things like that. I'm not saying it's not hard to get there and they're not demanding, but it's just a little bit of a different thinking. And so that's been a big thing.
Sure. Yeah, it sounds like there's a lot of opportunities in the field of OBGYN.
Lots of options.
Yeah. So specifically looking at practicing in a rural setting, what's the biggest barrier to practicing OBGYN in a rural setting?
I'm just going to speak from my own personal perspective, but I think it's probably going to be similar in other rural settings. Some of the barriers are not having access to resources that are needed. So I'm going to use this as a for instance. At my clinic, we, for the past 3-4 years, when we have pregnant patients, we've been having to send them to the hospital for their OB ultrasounds. And there are a couple of things. So I work in a rural medicine clinic, and we're sliding scale in the first place and insured. We take both, right? So some of the patients have had to pay what's called a sliding scale copay to come in the first place. Mm-hmm. Then as part of their obstetric care, they'll get various ultrasounds depending on what type of patient it is or the risk factors and things like that. When we send them to the hospital for those things, we have traditionally had to have them incur whatever cost it is. So we try to give them vouchers, but they're only for so much. And so they still have to pay for some of that. So that's a huge barrier to them getting the prenatal care that they need, right? Mm-hmm. So fortunately, as part of a grant, which you'll hear about grant programs with a lot of the rural medicine, rural health clinics, as part of a grant program, we've been able to purchase an ultrasound machine for our clinic and hire an ultrasound tech. So now when a patient comes to see us, they pay that sliding scale fee or whatever, and they have immediate access. That's really important because our patients, not only were they having to pay, but their ultrasounds had to be scheduled weeks in advance. And so somebody that has pelvic pain might be waiting 2 or 3 weeks for an ultrasound because the hospital can't necessarily accommodate our patients in a timely manner in the way that they can the emergency patients. And we're not a private clinic, so we didn't have that capability before. Mm-hmm. So that's been a big deal. That's one of the things that you'll see, you know, limited resources, and that's one of the ways that we've been able to meet it. You have to get sometimes a little bit creative with your prenatal care for patients because we're not just talking about limited resources, we're talking about patients with limited resources. So limited funds, limited ways to get to the clinic. Probably 70-80% of my prenatal patients are Spanish speaking. So we're talking about, you know, language barriers and things like that. We do have, thankfully, translators at the clinic, but there are a lot of those barriers that we struggle to overcome. So let's say, you know, we have a gestational diabetic mom who's going to require monitoring of blood sugars and things like that. Well, that sometimes means mom has to come back several times. So it's getting creative with how we do our antenatal testing, and this ultrasound is going to really help us with that because sometimes we can decrease the number of times that they come to the clinic if we've done the appropriate ultrasound for them during that week as far as their antenatal testing for diabetes. So just lots of challenges with rural medicine. Those are just a few, but they're big, they're huge. Mm-hmm. Being able to pay for your care, being able to get to an appointment, when you're having to prioritize that over, you know, taking my kids to school or buying food for the home or paying a bill for the home, it's a struggle. I mentioned grant programs a little while ago. We've got really great grant programs that cover our clinic as well, that cover, you know, not only sometimes the visit for patients that are there for what's called their annual wellness exam. So that covers their pap smear as well as their mammogram. Mm-hmm. And so anything that's found because of that, if they have an abnormal pap smear, abnormal mammogram, this grant covers that as well. So we've got some really great grant programs. I think the ultimate answer to that question, though, is just getting creative. Mm-hmm. And finding the funding and finding a way to meet needs for these medically underserved patients in a rural setting.
Yes. So you talked a lot about like the barriers are barriers to access to care in the field of OBGYN. Do you feel like telemedicine has improved, and do you use telemedicine in your current practice?
I don't use telemedicine in my current practice. I think we're a little bit out from that in terms of especially obstetric care. And especially when you're dealing with a higher risk population, that's a tough one. Because until we can make sure that each of those patients has, let's say, a blood pressure cuff or, you know, glucose monitoring that is accessible to me in some way from the office, as well as fetal heart monitors, Dopplers, things like that, until those patients have access to all of those things, I think providing especially prenatal care that way is a challenge. So no, I don't use telemedicine currently. Again, with a rural medicine clinic, I'm always willing to try, you know, innovative and new ideas to get out to patients. Most of the time for us, though, that's not occurring in the format of telemedicine. It's going to be more, you know, let's call this patient two or three times during the week and go over their blood sugars with them or something like that instead of telemed. But a lot of improvements. I think my honest opinion is that we could probably more efficiently meet the needs of some of those patients in those ways. But again, we also are talking about access things, right? So you need Wi-Fi access points and things like that. And a lot of my patients don't have that.
Yes, ma'am.
So it kind of sounds like a good idea, but if you don't, if I can't hear you talking on the other side, it's not gonna work. But I think, you know, definitely there are a lot of improvements to care that we can probably implement in that area.
Yes, ma'am. Well, now we'll move into our next segment, and it's surrounded by teaching future OBs. So as a professor, how do you prepare students for both the clinical and emotional realities of the field of OBGYN?
Well, I try to be honest and realistic. I think you guys hear me say this all the time. I think not just in the field of OBGYN, I think it's really, really important as a developing physician for you to be present in your learning. And to me, present in your learning is gonna mean that you're around other people who are like-minded and doing some of the same things. I think that's monumentally important. You learn how to communicate that way. And clinically, I think that's one of the best ways to prepare is to have chats and talk with your colleagues about, you know, patient situations and things like that. So I think that's one of the ways. I won't talk about classes and coming to class and all that. I know, you know, it's different, right? It's a generational thing. I think everybody learns a little bit of a different way. And I'm respectful of that, but at the end of the day, when you all finish your clinical, your preclinical and your clinical education, there's gonna have to be some level of learning of clinical communication with people. And so for me, I think trying to interact with you all as much as I can, you know, giving you experiences that I've had, stories that I've had, sharing that emotion, to me, that's what I'm trying to do to help prepare you all. I don't think it's perfect at all, but I think, to me, those are a couple of things that are important. Just remembering that your patients, whether it's an OBGYN patient or any other patient, these are they're humans, right? Mm-hmm. They're not a book. This could be your mom or your brother or your, well, in my case, it's not gonna be, but I'm just saying it could be your mom or your brother or your sister. You know, just connecting that emotion with what you're learning and the seriousness of it and the importance of it, I think, is important for y'all. I try to emulate that a little. I'm not sure I'm always successful, but nobody's ever perfect.
Yeah, and that definitely helps a lot. Like, When you're able to like interact with a professor like that, you definitely get a lot more from it than just seeing the lecture online. Like you're definitely missing a little bit there.
Well, I try to. I think so. I try to be. Now, every lecture is not a great lecture, right? Let's just face it. There are just some things that you have to learn that it's just, it might be better for you to sit, you know, at home on your couch and watch it five or six times before you know it. But I do think there is a little bit of importance to that human interaction with each other as future colleagues and just learning how to do that. It certainly, I think, makes things a lot more relaxed when you go out on third and fourth year rotations because you're used to interacting with people. Once you get out on those third and fourth year rotations, if you haven't spoken to any of your classmates for the 2 years or your professors, you might be a little nervous for the at least the first few, right?
Yeah, so. I can see that. And speaking of third and fourth years, what advice might you have for medical students hoping to match into your specialty?
So the advice that I have is that if you feel like you really are drawn to this field, that you go for it. You know, I think it's important for us to set up realistic expectations for you guys in terms of your ability to match this or that, but I'm gonna be honest with you. I think that just a drive to do it, learning what you can, I encourage you guys to talk to as many people as you can as third and fourth years. I think it's a great idea for you all as third and fourth years, and even before that, to get involved in the professional societies like ACOOG, meet program directors, meet other residents from other programs, and really get your name out there. I think that's an important thing. But overall, I think just being interested on your rotations and reading and making sure that you're able to answer questions that your attendings are asking. But then if it's something that you choose that you want to do and you feel passionate about it, not veering off that course and not getting discouraged. You know, there are a lot of different ways to get where you want to go. And if you set your mind to it, I'm a firm believer. This may be still naive of me and idealistic, but I've always been a firm believer that if you set your mind to something that you're passionate about, that's planted there for a reason, and you can get there if with the right amount of effort. Now, let's be clear, I didn't say you'll get there the first time. What I said was, if you have that passion and you work hard, you will get there. I feel passionate about that because I was not an ideal candidate for an OBGYN rotation, and it just clicked with me. I was passionate about it, and I think the people that interviewed me saw that in me, and I think that was important. And I also think, you know, as third and fourth years, you have to remember too that you need to be humble. When you ultimately do interview for a residency position, it's a job. So there's a team that you're going to be joining. So you want to be acutely aware of the fact that you want to be helpful to the team, right? And by being helpful, I mean being a productive team member, because we all want a productive team member as part of our team, right? So if you show up on rotations and you're not fully there and you're not willing to help and you've got other things to do, you're not interested, that's gonna come across. And you know, when you get the chance to interview, it may come out that perhaps you weren't as much of a productive team member. And so maybe somebody who came along after you might have been more productive. So be acutely aware of those things. So.
Yeah, that sounds like very sound advice for anyone trying to match into any specialty.
For sure.
Yeah. And we know that you take students with you to rotate from our school. How do you balance giving students autonomy while working with you, while also ensuring that patient safety is there as well?
Well, first of all, when I have students with me, they're never doing anything without me being there. So call that autonomy or not. I usually start students off every month, because it's a monthly thing, right? So I get to spend time with you all monthly. So I start you off where we kind of do one-on-one shadowing. So have students come with me into every room after getting permission from the patients, because that's important too, right? Mm-hmm. It's a tough thing sometimes because, you know, sometimes the patients don't want someone else in the room, and that's okay. That's never, should never be taken as anything offensive, or, you know, that you're a bad student or anything like that. But I usually start you all off with just one-on-one with me. And then as you get a little more comfortable, I'll let you go and collect a history or something like that. And then present it to me. And as long as I feel like you're hitting the high points and you're collecting an appropriate history, then we go maybe to that next step where, with the permission of patients, you might be able to do an exam or participate in a procedure or something like that. So that's how I sort of approach it. I know on other rotations it might be a little bit different. So to me, the ultimate autonomy, towards the end of the rotation with me, you know, if I have you going into the room and helping me, you know, presenting to me and developing a plan, then we may go on to procedures and things like that. So I think when you ask me about autonomy on my rotation, that's probably what it looks like. And it varies by student, right? Because some of the students are very interested in OBGYN and some are not interested in OBGYN. So that has to be taken into account as well, right? I never force it. It's always if you choose to participate in some ways, then as long as it's okay with patients, then, you know.
Yeah, definitely.
You do that.
Before we go, we do have a couple of quick questions that we can run through as well. So just to start, what's your favorite OB procedure?
C-section. Yeah. It's always been a C-section. I just love them. They're usually pretty quick. You get a nice little prize towards the end. And they're procedures that are relatively, I'm going to say relatively benign, and then I'm thinking of all the complications that can happen. So I don't mean it in that way, but that's just always been my favorite one. It's very rewarding. Mm-hmm. So, and yeah. I love gynecologic. That's my obstetric, right? Gynecologic. I love a robotic assisted hysterectomy.
Okay. Yeah, that's very cool. Like, I'm super excited about all of the like surgical advancements and like tech doing surgeries robotically. But what's one thing you wish your patients knew about their own body?
Oh gosh, I wish every day that patients were more educated about their anatomy and processes, and that maybe TikTok and Google are not the best sources of that information. It is always shocking to me how very little sometimes patients know about just their menstrual cycle, and how misconceptions about that sort of perpetuate through the generations. And sometimes I really, really wish that we spent more time, this probably is a controversial thing, so I will not say anything more than this, but I really wish we were able to spend more time in schools educating young women about their bodies and development, as well as young men too, but from a gynecologic perspective, for me, that's a big deal. I see some really sometimes sad things that I think if women had been more aware of various things that maybe it wouldn't have happened. They wouldn't have ended up sometimes with various conditions. Mm-hmm. So.
Yes. Got it. Next, what's the best part about delivering babies in a small town, or when you used to deliver babies more so in the hospital?
So the best part of that was just being a part of that. That's not just in a small town. That's mm-hmm. that's in a big town too. But also, I had the fortune mm-hmm. of being the only female OBGYN in the town that I was practicing, mm-hmm. and the hospital, mm-hmm. and so that was very rewarding, very interesting. Mm-hmm. It's a small town, so there's nowhere that you can go that you don't meet somebody that you've delivered their baby or, and I still, it's very interesting, even in Hattiesburg, and I'm not in Laurel anymore, but even in Hattiesburg, I run across people every once in a while that'll say, oh, you delivered my baby, and they'll show 4 and 5 and 6 and 7 and 8 and now 10 and 11 year old pictures of their babies. That's very rewarding. I don't think that happens in bigger towns. But definitely that was very, I took a sense of pride.
Yeah, that sounds really cool.
Very, like, very, very humbling, and it's an honor, very much an honor.
Yeah, I can kind of relate to that too. I come from a smaller place, mm-hmm. and whenever like my grandma would be at the store, she'd see the doctor that delivered me, and she'd show me, or show pictures of me to her and stuff like that.
Yep.
And she kind of delivered the whole town as well, so.
Yeah.
What's an underrated aspect about being an OBGYN that people may not appreciate enough?
I think the underrated aspect of it is that, you know, we're often seen as very happy-go-lucky and, you know, friendly as a profession, I think, but it can be very serious. It can get very serious very fast. Your patients can get very sick very fast, and not only just your one patient, oftentimes it's two patients. Mm-hmm. So I think that's probably what I would say to that answer, mm-hmm. to that question.
Sure.
Is that it's just it can get very serious.
Right. Yeah. Important to find balance.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what's a go-to snack that helps you get through long shifts?
So anything peanut butter, apples. Mm-hmm. In residency was Lorna Doone crackers, but they it's honestly, you know, just whatever is kind of around that's like a little protein and a little sweet. I was joking with some of the first years a couple weeks ago when I was doing a lecture on nutrition. I brought up a slide about pregnancy and caffeine mm-hmm. use, and so I was curious to know about some drinks that I've had in the past and how much caffeine they had, right?
Yes.
So you've got the teas, you've got Alani's, you've got Celsius. Of course, none of that was around when I was in residency, but the one thing that I did drink is I always had a Diet Mountain Dew. Mm-hmm. So, and I thought that was a lot of caffeine. It's mm-hmm. nothing compared to some of those other ones. Now, what gets me through is coffee.
Yes, I'm sure a lot of us medical students are running on caffeine
yep.
and jokes.
But even the coffee doesn't have as much as the Alani and the Celsius. Yes. Oh my gosh.
Yeah, right. We have some Celsius warriors in our class, and it's always exciting to see them around. So lastly, what's something you learned from a patient that changed how you practice?
I don't think that it's something per se that I learned from any specific patient. Mm-hmm. As much as it is that I learned from other attendings and other physicians that I work around, and that's not to say anybody's bad, so I'm not downing anybody, but I just what I learned, well, and in some ways it's from patients too, is that patients are humans. They're not a number. They want to be treated like people, and they want somebody to sit and talk to them. Mm-hmm. So in my training, any attending that I was ever around who emulated that, mm-hmm. I always felt myself thinking, I'm going to be like that. And the response that I've gotten back from patients when I do sit down and take the time to do that, mm-hmm. I think that's what I would say.
Yeah, that's amazing. Like, I always pride myself on trying to be the doc who, like, connects with their patient.
Yeah.
And not seeing them just as a body, but as a person.
And it's not always possible. Now, I'm going to be realistic with you all. Sometimes it's tough, but that brings great satisfaction. So, and you all will see when you get out on rotations, you're gonna see situations where you're gonna say, I'm gonna do that, or I don't think I'm ever gonna do that. It's all a learning experience, right? But yeah,
gotcha.
a lot of satisfaction and pride.
And my last question is, so recently there's been a new series come out called The Pit. I'm not sure if you're familiar, but it's been raved about for how accurate it is and things of that nature. But just with that in mind, do you have a medical drama that you like to watch or anything that's ever caught your eye? I know there are millions of them that have been on forever.
Well, for me coming up, it was ER. And I know that's a throwback, but the guy from ER is on The Pit. He's the main character in The Pit, right?
I think so, actually.
Yeah.
So yes, Dr. Mitchell was sharing that with me. I didn't know. So now I have to go watch.
ER was great. And so you know, you always have those dramas where people are doing things that you feel like you want to do. And that for me, ER was it. That was my medical drama.
Yes, the big one for all of us was always Grey's Anatomy, but I think now we have something new to kind of fixate on. Mm-hmm. So that's been amazing to watch, especially with it being so accurate.
Do y'all mind if I ask a last-minute question? I know I've just been here on tech mainly, but Dr. Roberts, I'm sure you know everyone listening from Cary knows exactly who you are and would agree with me that you're a superwoman, basically. I mean, you do it all. You're a super mom. You're very involved on campus, not just with classes, but clubs. You're, you know, sponsors for multiple clubs, and you're active with them. You go to the events, and you're always looking amazing, beautiful, and so stylish.
Wow.
And I just, I want to know how you do it all and how you balance it. And what advice do you have, especially for future women in medicine who their expectations and responsibilities are often seen, you know, differently compared to men, even though it, you know, is often unfair? What advice do you have to share with us?
So, first of all, thank you for saying all of that.
It's true.
Not how I see
myself.
That's really that and you, Seth. What you said when we started this, I'm like, I'm gonna have him introduce me some other time. I'm gonna be blatantly honest with you. There have been times in my life when I've been really good at balancing things, and times in my life when I have really not been good at balancing things at all. I think the biggest advice I have for both male and female physicians is gonna be just learning from that. And giving yourself grace when you don't balance things very well, and taking the lessons from that and learning from it and really implementing some of the things that would have made that different. So I think balance is something that you learn. It's something that I continue to learn. And again, it's interesting that you say all those nice things about me, but there are some days that I get up and I'm like, I am not balancing this well today. And you just have to... I have to stop and give myself grace and just say, what is it in this moment that has to be done, and what is it in this moment that I'm struggling with, and doing what I can to change that. And sometimes you just can't change those things. But for me, that's been, you know, the process of balance is something that you really need to learn. As a female physician with children and a husband, that can be really tough, because there are times, especially in some of the more demanding fields, when your career and your job, your residency is going to take priority over everything. But it goes back to the balance, right? You have to try to balance that out and not swing the pendulum too far to the other side. Life is too short not to love those people around you, and you love your career and that's okay, but your career is not going to be there at the end of the day for you. Sadly, it's a job, and your family's not a job, right? So you have to remember that. Asking for help, you have to ask for help, especially as a mom with smaller children, trying to, you know, get your kids to school. You have to help. Ask for help. You have to use your resources that are available to you and not feel bad about it. I spent an awful lot of time coming up feeling terrible about going out for call and spending 24 hours call. My older daughter, who's about to graduate, I would leave for call and she would literally grab my leg and cry mm-hmm. the whole way. And I'm feeling terrible about that, you know? Mm-hmm. Does she remember that now? No. And so I was feeling worse about it. Now, that's not to say it wasn't traumatic for her. I'm sure that it was. And she would tell you it was terribly traumatic. My other daughter, who's 15, doesn't remember much of that. Mm-hmm. She just remembers it as part of life. So kids are different. They're going to remember it. We're always harder on ourselves about those things than our kids are ultimately going to be. They're very resilient. Mm-hmm. But, you know, asking for help. I have a lot of funny stories about, you know, one of the local surgeons in town. We had kids about the same age, and they would go to the same, like, after-school camps and things like that. And I would drive up. Our kids were always the last ones there, right? So I would drive up if her kids were still there. I would say, hey, you know, call her up. Hey, you want me to grab your kiddos? And she's like, yeah, thanks. And she'd do the same for me. And it's just, you know, you learn to accept those, that help with grace. And you do it for those coming behind you. Mm-hmm. And you remember how that felt. Mm-hmm. So.
Yes. Well, thank you.
Yes, and I think all of us, even though we're in our earlier years of starting our medical journey, I think we've all felt the struggle of, like, balancing, whether mm-hmm. just be calling your family back home to say, hey, I'm alive, I'm breathing, and things like that. And I don't think we did you any justice earlier. And it's amazing that Karina brought it up, because she is a superwoman, because I popped up on Saturdays and she's volunteering. Every time she gives a lecture, the hall is normally always full. She always brings us snacks, and we can't tell that you are having a balancing act. We think you're a superwoman, like they mentioned earlier.
Well, thank you.
Wanted to drop that in.
It's really sweet for you to say that.
Guys, got anything else?
That's all I got.
Thank you. You've been amazing.
Well, Dr. Roberts, thank you for joining us today. For this incredible work you're doing in both the rural medicine and osteopathic education, it's clear that your passion for OBGYN and your dedication to underserved communities are inspiring the next generation of physicians. To our listeners, we hope today this episode gave you a deeper look into the evolving world of women's health, the unique challenges of rural care, and what it truly means to lead with compassion and purpose in medicine. As always, if you enjoyed this episode, be sure to follow us on your favorite platform, share it with your classmates or colleagues, and leave us a review. And remember, whether you're delivering babies, delivering care, or just trying to survive your second year of medical school, you're doing it right. Thank you.